Hey there, my Toonami generation. Just a bit of word of warning for this episode before we get started. I go into a very long-winded diatribe dealing with sort of Pocahontas' sort of controversial history at the beginning of this episode. So, probably for your sake, it might be best for you to fast forward to the 26-minute mark where this will probably pick up with the synopsis and maybe listen to the diatribe at a later date. So that's, I just want to give you that warning. Besides, of course, obviously, spoilers. Duh. But, if you just want to skip the diatribe, jump to the 26-minute mark and enjoy the show.
Hey there, this is your old buddy Tom, the Toonami Operations Module. Settle in, it's about to get good. Toonami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me, I've waited long enough.
As I gaze upon the beautiful abyss of outer space, I can't help but reminisce on how we held onto our faith. Gold is how we stayed till the day that time would say that Toonami's back, bitches. Pardon my Francais. Now every week the absolution blasts off while the masses watch as an old familiar mascot by the name of Tom takes a seat and kicks the broadcast off, making major moves like a triple cut backdrop. I still remember watching that Beyond doing damage and thinking, damn, is Goku ever gonna reach Namek? Obviously, I got a lot of love for the classics. The speed at which I used to run home to watch was the fastest. Absolution moving, flying through the galaxy. Toonami's back with a slap in the face to those who doubted it. Remain Toonami faithful till the day that I am gray and old. And like a Super Saiyan's glow, I will always stay gold.
This is Nerdcore Absolution. Come to peace with your inner nerd, and after you can stay gold like T.O.M. Chilling out the galaxy, and we know him.
From a perch among the stars, as you was awake the moment when the spirit bomb.
Hey, my Toonami generation, and welcome to a brand new episode of Tom's Prerogative right here on the Absolution Network. I am your captain of the Absolution, Thomas Primetime Mattis, and this is episode 134 of The Prerogative. And on this episode, we start Disney Month, one of our more beloved moments that we get to do here in Tom's Prerogative, where we cover Walt Disney Animation Classics. And this time out, we're actually going to cover one of the last, and I do believe actual last, Walt Disney Animation movies that we haven't covered from the 90s. We've pretty much covered everything. We've covered Tarzan. We've covered Mulan, Hercules, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Lion King, Aladdin, Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, twice, I believe. Or at least once. I know there's like Bug's Life and Toy Story, but I'm not counting those. I'm counting those as Pixar. There may be something I'm missing, probably, and I apologize, but as far as the 90s is concerned, this is the last one that, to my mind, I can think of, you know, as far as hand-drawn animation, and that's Pocahontas, a Disney animated film I thought I reviewed before. In fact, I particularly remember working on the recording, and it being as stressful as this one has been as far as striving to start over and over. And I probably said, to hell with it. I'm getting burned out doing this episode because it's very difficult for very obvious reasons that will be talked about in just a couple moments. And said, I'm going to do something else. And ended up doing something else because I probably missed my schedule threshold. Because I was probably pushing myself on a very strict schedule. But, as it turns out, I hadn't reviewed this yet. So, and being that it is one of those movies as part of Disney's 1990s renaissance. And there's a lot to talk about with this movie. Among one of my favorite Disney songs of all time. Yeah. So, this episode we talk Pocahontas. That and more on this episode, because like I said, there is a lot of things to talk about with this film, including controversies that we've sort of may have made mention to last episode with Balto, as far as people being angry at the film. Of course, this film having a morality tale, a part of it that we'll be discussing along with that controversy, but also we'll be discussing in the review proper, because I want to talk about how that morality tale connects this film with people and themes that are still going today, and it does serve an important lesson to teach. And, you know, let's talk about what that lesson is. That lesson is that we're not as different as we make each other out to be. We're actually very much like each other. And it's important for us to realize how like we are and to treat each other fairly and equally. And, you know, we're not savages. To not look at other people who are different than you because they have different skin color or different belief systems as savages. Put to realize how alike we are and to, you know, because we're all one human family under the sky. And how important it is, you know, again, to treat each other with kindness and fairness and everything. And that's a lesson we can all learn. Even I still can learn it and still, you know, use to remind me to treat people fairly, even if they vehemently anger me. Like certain political parties who have no backbone and want to rob from the poor and give to the rich. Not that I'm naming names. And if I could whistle, I would whistle right here. You know, that's sort of one of the sort of thematic devices used in this movie. But of course, even with good intention, the movie being the story that it's based on brings controversy. You know, again, this is a movie that is based on the folk tale, the oral traditions, and written retellings of a romanticization of the meetings between English explorer and settler John Smith and the young Indian Pocahontas. And this sort of fits in, to me, it fits into folktales very much like, you know, Paul Bunyan and other folktales of the like, sort of the folktales that Disney used to sort of tell about in stories during the Walt Disney years in like the 50s and stuff. And anything that involves actual historical events, you know, as we made mention before, like with Balto, brings controversy because there are people that demand that any film that covers anything historical be historically accurate. You know, there are those who think that, you know, the film is historically inaccurate because they feel that, again, through the romanticization, failed to cover how awful the settlers treat the Indians, which, I don't know, I watched the movie. I think it was, you know, firmly entrenched that outside of John Smith, who has chosen to, you know, realize that maybe he was wrong about the Indians, they showcased the settlers as sort of narcissistic, sexist jackwagons until they realized they were wrong. But then again, that's sort of a theme. Like, we can all realize we're wrong because, again, that goes to the battle scene. Again, we'll discuss that battle scene and why it works so much more later. But I mean, this is a kid's film, and you got people apparently wanting them to be more historically accurate by their words. I guess they want a kid's film to talk about settlers raping, you know, Indian women, which I don't understand. Like, why? Why would you want to show children that? That doesn't make any sense. Well, they need to learn what is historically accurate. No, they don't need to learn what is historically accurate if they're, like, children. Feeling that it's not accurate about Native American history. And, you know, let's be honest about this. Native Americans have been screwed six ways from Sunday in American history. From the time that the settlers appeared and say, we're not going to take your land, we're not going to take your land, we're not going to... by the way, this is now our land. Can you just, you know, scoot away? To Indian Wars, to being pushed onto the reservation system, to being refused as American citizens. To this day, Native Americans continue to be screwed over and over and over again. And if you don't believe me, all you have to do is look at the Dakota Pipeline fiasco. It's just awful what has happened to Native Americans in not just in American history, but still to this day. And it's, we definitely should be doing better on. And I don't think anybody with any intelligent person with common sense would say the same thing. I think the only people who would say otherwise are ignorant people who don't know better. And let's be honest, there's no saving them. All that being said about the controversy, I think it's misplaced. And it's for the same reasons I talked about with Balto. Again, this is a family film. Basically, they are doing the fairy tale of Pocahontas. You know, I remember having this discussion with my sister long ago, and multiple people, but, you know, in this case, it's the fairy tale. It's the jumping on point. You know, they're using the fairy tale to tell the morality tale, as I mentioned before, about realizing how we are all equal and to realize how alike we are. And to tell that fairy tale. And when you have an entertaining movie that's fun to watch to where it's not becoming overly preachy, and of course there's a question about that in this film, whether they achieved that. We'll get to that in the review. But when you have that film be entertaining, it can be a great jumping off point for kids to start to want to learn about Native American culture, for adults who, like, you know, this has got me interested in maybe looking on Native American culture. You know, I know as an adult, if I watch something that intrigues me, I get invested in wanting to learn more about it. You know, I was watching something on British castles the other day. It was on Netflix. It was something on two episodes on one was on Dover Castle and one was on the Tower of London. And by the way, in the Tower of London, apparently one of the horrible things that happened was the imprisoning of Jews and the scapegoating of Jews. I can't remember by which king, but during a crisis where counterfeit coins were being made, and so they needed to find a scapegoat, and they scapegoat the Jews, to which I yelled out, "Of course they scapegoat the Jews! Because whenever anybody needs a scapegoat, the Jews are always at the top of the list." And I looked over at my mother like, because people hate us, don't they? My people, the Jewish people, are the most hated people around. Because we're always the scapegoats. And all you have to do is look in history to see that. But, it's, now I'm thinking about that a lot. Because I amuse myself sometimes in being funny like that. Or at least attempting to be funny. But, you know, my point is that, you know, I watched those things on the castles, and I became more interested in, like, well, this is really neat. I'd love to learn more about the castles and everything. Like, the Dover episode, it brought up the operations during World War II at Dunkirk, which it just so happened earlier in the day I had gone to see a movie, a wonderful movie called Kong Skull Island, and there was a trailer for something called Dunkirk. I'm like, oh, that's what this is going to be about, which makes me interested in seeing the movie and also learning more about Operation Dunkirk. You know, these movies can be a jumping off point to want to learn more about culture. I know for a fact that in 1994, as a kid, I watched Enjoy the film, and it made me more interested in wanting to learn about Native American culture. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Wanting to learn more about what happened to Native Americans, it definitely made me more sympathetic to what has happened to Native Americans at an early age. You know, You know, it's funny, I hear people say that these films demonize Native Americans along with other films, but it's like, it's, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and all my friends have been concerned, and all the friends that I've had, not one of us has ever, like, looked at Native Americans as evil. Certainly there are some movies where they're depicted as the bad guys, but we never looked at them as evil. In fact, to be quite honest, I think one thing that has changed about my generation as opposed to past generations, you know, when we play Cowboys and Indians, you know, in the past, people, you know, my mother's generations and generations before that, you know, they all wanted to be the cowboys that took down the Indians. But my generation wanted to be the Indians stopping the cowboys and saving, you know, the tribe. So it's hard to sort of look at, you know, the complaint of these films demonizing Native Americans when it's actually done quite the opposite in my experience. Now, of course, that is my experience. I have no right to speak for everybody. But at the same time, that's sort of my other criticism is it feels like you have some people who are trying to use controversy as power gains in an attempt to speak for a bunch of people that they don't really speak for, just because they share the same culture. You know, this goes to the whole idea of cultural appropriation and everything. You know, I've seen sort of the same thing with, you know, the discussion about the Washington Redskins football team. You know, because I'll be honest, when I hear the name Washington Redskins, I think of a proud Indian warrior, if I think about an Indian warrior at all, because I either think that, or I think, hey, yeah, the football team. There's nothing negative that I think there. That's not to sit there and say that the word wasn't used in negative context in the past, but, you know, words evolve. And, you know, the thing about it is, that I'm getting to, is, like, they've continuously done polls among Native Americans, and it's pretty much split. Some are offended by it, some aren't. So who gets to speak for who? You know, there are been movies that depict Jewish culture, some by non-Jews. And I've been somewhat offended by how they depict the Jews, but, you know, just because I'm offended doesn't mean other Jews are. Then again, I'm also a pretty hard person to offend, quite honestly. I mean, I'm a guy that enjoys playing a good game of Cards Against Humanity. And if you know Cards Against Humanity, you know the type of jokes that get made during those games. But I guess the point I'm trying to make is that all the controversy seems very superficial. It doesn't mean that it's not completely invalid, and that we shouldn't worry about how people are depicted, especially minority cultures are depicted in film, cinema, pop culture. But my experience is that a lot of time the movies they're talking about are trying to depict minorities in a very positive way. In this movie in particular, as far as between the two cultures, the settlers are shown to be absolute dicks. I mean, the Powhatans are completely justified in not being trusting of the strangers. They don't go and try to attack them. They're just observing them when, you know, one gets spotted and the settlers immediately open fire. It's their land that's being taken over. You know, they have every right to act the way they are. But again, as we'll get into, you know, this is a story about stopping, recognizing that even though we may look different, we are the same, and, you know, to love each other and treat each other equally and fair. You know, I think that morality tale is a lot more bigger and should be given a lot more attention in regards to this film than what some people might try to use this film as, a form of political power grab. I'm going to stop right there because I could go on and on. There's so much to talk about with this film in regards to, its depiction of Native Americans, its depiction of English settlement. And like I said, I could go on for hours. Honestly, I think it's a fascinating topic to discuss. And again, this is what a good film can do. It can cause discussion. And that's never a bad thing. You know, I'm just particularly talking about the people who want to make it, you know, people who may enjoy this film feel guilty and feel horrible for enjoying it under the guise of being offended by it and not realizing that these films, you know, like Balto, like Pocahontas here, like Moana, which, yes, we will be reviewing Moana later in the month. All these films can open up people's eyes to different cultures, new history that they may have not known, in particular for children. And if we focus on that rather than the negatives, because I certainly think that the positives from this film outweigh any negatives, and realizing, more importantly, that this is not a film that's trying to attempt to tell the accurate historical story of Pocahontas. This is a fairy tale based on oral and written lore. It's a natural American fairy tale, and it's being used to tell a bigger morality tale. I think we can realize this is a really good film to watch and really enjoyable. And yeah, I'm going to leave it there. Because I'm probably already in trouble. Because anytime you talk about a sensitive subject, you know, I seem to get in trouble. But I feel that these things are very important to talk about. And to be very open about. Because more importantly, I hate when good films are demonized for political power play. If that makes any sense. It's not to sit there and say that people don't have the right to be offended, but I also think that, you know, just while one person has the right to not be has the right to be offended, so does another person have the right not to be offended by the movie. And I think everybody should take any film for that matter, you know, based on their own opinion. You know, I don't like Twilight for that matter. That doesn't mean you shouldn't watch Twilight. I can give my honest review of it, but you should still judge on your own whether to watch Twilight. This is, by the way, is a topic that's been a recent talk among geek culture, as there have been a lot of bad reviews for the Iron Fist series, which is debuting soon on Netflix. And yeah, there's a lot of reviewers that seemingly want to guilt people into not watching this. That's a whole different topic altogether, though. So why don't we actually get into today's topic proper? As we get ready to review Pocahontas. So, our story starts in 1607 as a young Powhatan Indian named Pocahontas is the strong, independent daughter of the Powhatan chief of the Powhatan tribe, which lives in what is now Virginia. She was recently announced by her father to wed the brave Powhatan warrior Kokuum, which Pocahontas kind of vehemently disagrees with, as she feels he's far too serious for her. Meanwhile, her friend is like, well, if you don't want to give him to me, hubba, hubba, hubba. But one day, while she is talking to the spirit of a willow tree called Grandma Willow, she spots strange clouds. These aren't clouds, though. These are the sails of an English ship of the Virginia Company, led by Governor Ratcliffe, whose men have come to the New World to create the Jamestown Colony. And, more importantly for Ratcliffe's purposes, to find gold. One of the men on this ship is Captain John Smith, an experienced Indian hunter and explorer who is respected and adored by most of the men, especially the young, influential Thomas. And in return, Smith is, very, I'm sure, taken back by, Thomas's lithe figure, as he's very lean and cut, and I'm sure he's asked one time, Thomas, how'd you get so cut? To which Thomas replied, I don't wear hockey pants. Alright, you knew that Dark Knight reference was coming, along with any other Batman reference from the Baleverse was coming. You knew it was coming. Yeah, I was horrible for making that joke, but you knew it was coming, and you know more are yet to come. So don't complain. initially, both settlers and the Powhatans distrust each other, and a slight misunderstanding happens when, scouting the settlers, one is spotted, and it leads to a small skirmish. Both sides, therefore, start preparations for a future battle they believe is yet to come. Meanwhile, while exploring, Smith meets Pocahontas, and the two begin to teach each other about their cultures, and slowly but surely start to fall in love with each other. But when one late-night meeting leads to a internet meme of Kokuum, and his death by Thomas, and by the way, you think I'm kidding about that? Try watching this movie now, after that internet meme became famous, without thinking about that. You can't. Trust me, I tried. I was watching it like, oh my god, I can never watch this movie the same way again because of the internet. Thank you for ruining something, internet. Because of that, or not the internet meme, but because of Kokuum's ambush and his death by Thomas trying to save Smith, Smith tells Thomas to run and takes the blame for Kokuum's killing, and Smith is captured, and the drums of war are started. As the two sides began to face off, it's now up to Pocahontas to save John and stop the massacre from happening. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Pocahontas.
You think you own whatever land you land on? The earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has a life, has a spirit, has a name. You think the only people who are people people who look and think like you. But if you walk the footsteps of a stranger, you learn things you never knew, you never knew. Have you ever heard the wolf cry to the blue corn moon, or ask the grinning buck at
Just one thing before, though. I apologize for being long-winded. I'm probably going to put something in front of this episode to warn you that I was long-winded. I actually have faint memories of, like I said, I have faint memories of doing this review before, and it didn't work out. And I think my faint memories were connected to the fact that I also felt like I had to talk about the controversy. And I was about as long-winded then as I am now. So, needless to say, I'm apologizing for my long-windedness and going into a subject that I just felt it was too hard not to talk about. So apologize for that, but hopefully you're still with me. Hopefully, actually, you took my advice that I'm probably going to give at the beginning of this very show, and you skipped ahead. Let's get into the review proper. And we are starting with the music, as we always do. And that means let's start with the songs. And I very much actually enjoyed all the songs. I think each one works in its own way, and it moves the story forward. And it's actually very interesting. There were more songs planned, but they cut a number of them out. I would have liked to have heard them. In fact, one of them, I think, like when you first get to the credits, there's a pop song that I believe is based on a song that was actually cut out. There's this like love song, like "What If I Never Knew You," that was supposed to take place during the sort of the late night rendezvous, the one that takes place right before the ambush, the one where Pocahontas and John Smith kiss. By the way, spoiler alert, they kiss. By the way, did you know that Darth Vader is Luke's dad? And did you know that Russell Crowe escapes from L.A.? Anyways, so there were songs cut out. But I enjoyed all the songs that they kept in. One thing I think Disney is very, very underrated on is they usually do these little songs, these little sort of intro songs at the beginning of movies and everything, that I think get vehemently underrated. I can think of Frozen as an example of this. That, like, it just sets the mood for the story. Now, whether they're successful with the story is, another discussion. I.e., go listen to me and Chris's review of Frozen from, 2014? I believe. 2014, 2015, one of those years. It's one right before my two-episode, four-hour epic review of Hunchback of Notre Dame. And all of this is very much besides the point. I told you I was long-winded. But, there's sort of the Virginia Company song that sort of introduces John Smith and the English settlers getting on the ship. Then you have the sort of the storm scene to where Smith saves Thomas and setting up their relationship and the crew's relationship with Governor Ratcliffe. And then them getting to the new world, after the rescue, and they start singing again. And it's just a great opening and this also sort of combines with score of, as that song ends, you then hear sort of the Native American drums and the lead in there as the title sequence appears. So it's just a great little opening. It sort of sets the mood for the movie that I very much enjoyed. There was that. And then all the other little songs, because there's that, there's the Pocahontas songs that are there as they're returning home. There's all these little mini lyrical songs that really are more part of the score, but they really add themselves throughout the movie, and they sort of blend the score with the songs very well. I love Just Around the River Bend. It's such a fun, energetic song. And it's really sort of a character introduction to Pocahontas. Of like, here's how Pocahontas is very much different from everybody else in her tribe. You know, and it starts off with, you know, her father saying, you know, starting off the song, you know, talking about the river being steady and everything. Steady as a drum, you know. And, you know, that's her father, that's her friend, that's Kokuom, that's all and everybody who is in her tribe. You know, they are steady, like the steady river. But then she brings up, like, but the river isn't steady, it's changing, it's always different. You never step in the same river twice. Those really brilliant lyrics. And it's a great character introduction as a song to Pocahontas' personality. You know, her being a free spirit, a free thinker, a dreamer. You know, she's the person that thinks outside the box, you know, who is looking forward to what's just around the river bend, while everybody else is like, you know, not looking to the future. They're looking at the past and the present. She's engaged in what's coming in the future. She is engaged in, you know, like I said, just around the river bend. And there's that really important part at the end of the song to where she gets to the split and there's the river staying larger and being more steady, but the smaller stream to the right that's more sort of rapidly and maybe a bit more fun. And she's standing up like, you know, do I just do what everybody tells me to do? Do I marry Kokuom? Do I just accept the inevitable? Do I let fate be decided for me, or do I decide fate? And that's sort of another thing that is slightly talked about within her character development, but unfortunately doesn't get talked as much as I would like to in this movie. Is there is a slight thing in her character story about her deciding her own fate. But it's really becomes a very small subplot that it's important, but it isn't. Well, we'll get more into that because that sort of combines with the sort of Romeo-Juliet-esque-ness of this story, which we'll get into a little bit more. And then, of course, there's I'm trying to think of the song order. I believe the next song is Mine. It's the song where Governor Ratcliffe I'm hesitant to call it a villain song because it kind of is a villain song. It's like, it's a look into Ratcliffe's mind, but also the settlers' mission here. You know, the whole, like, we're here to get gold, so dig, boys, dig, boys. And I really enjoy the melody. Again, one thing I like about a lot of the songs here is, like, you have, you know, of course, some of the more memorable songs do use more Native American music and Native American instruments, and work really well on that. But then there's also sort of the contrast with, you know, the song, you know, this song in particular, Savages, which has, you know, where the settler side uses English instruments. You know, I can't think of the name of the instruments, and I apologize. But sort of the English sort of folk sort of music that would be of the time period. And you hear it in this song, and it makes a very pleasant, wonderful melody that works, I think, really well. By the way, the music was done by Alan Menken and Stefan Schwartz, and this was actually the first movie, the official first movie, where at least one song wasn't, or at least where Alan Menken hadn't worked on at least one song with Howard Ashman, because, of course, he had died towards the tail end of the production of, I think, right before Beauty and the Beast premiered, And during that time, he had worked on several of the songs of Aladdin, or at least most of them. And he had, I think, worked on at least one song for Lion King. So this is sort of that first official where there was like no input from Howard Ashman. And Stephen Schwartz was also a lyrical writer and a melody creator. So there was, like Alan Menken was, so there was, not butting of the heads, but like they had to find common ground and like who works on what and everything. And I thought they did a really good job. Of course, I'm using that to stall for time to before I talk about what is one of my top five Disney songs of all time. Colors in the Wind. That being said, I think I enjoy it more, the pop version more, than here where it's... I think the one problem with it in the movie is that it's just... Or at least in the beginning, it just seems to be a bit fast. But again, this goes to a sort of a larger pacing issue that is with this movie. But even with that, this is me nitpicking. Like, if I had to find something that was wrong with this song, what could it be? Because when you talk about musicals, when you talk about Disney songs, when you talk about a song that sort of captures the heart of what the plot and the story and the themes of a movie is, Colors in the Wind is perfect. It's, you know, I mean, beyond the fact that it's catchy like I Believe I Can Fly. Like, there are several songs that have been so catchy that out of the blue, I'll just start singing them. I Believe I Can Fly is one of them. Like, and I think it's something that everybody understands. Like, anybody will just, like, for some reason, they'll hear some type of musical note and go, I believe I can fly. But the other one for me is Colors in the Wind. Or I'll just be bored. I'll go, like, you think you own whatever land you land on. That the earth is just a dead thing you can claim. But I know every rock and tree and creature has a voice, has a spirit, has a name. And again, I think that goes actually back to also the fact that in fourth grade at Robinson Challenge Elementary School, lovely elementary school, I was part of chorus, and we actually sung Just Around the River Bend and Colors of the Wind as part of our, I think, our Thanksgiving celebration. Because Florida schools are what, we're just going to leave that there. that leaves room for long-windedness. But Colors of Wind, just lyrically brilliant. Melody-wise, it's just so... the song is engaging, and it's so full of energy. And the real big part where it goes, have you ever heard the wolf cry to the blue cold moon? Oh, you know, just that big raise in power and energy within the song is so brilliant and so well done and executed wonderfully. Judy Kahn, by the way, was Pocahontas' singing voice, who was in the actual running to voice Pocahontas herself, but that went to, and I have the, say, scoot up here, Irene Bedard, who, by the way, both, from my understanding, are Native American or have Native American heritage in them. Which was one of the things, is like, they actually went and brought Native Americans in to do voice work. You know, well, I'm not going to get into the whole, that whole discussion. I'm opening the door, but I'm closing it just as quick, because I'm like, I don't want to be here all night, okay? I'm sure it's enough and enough trouble as it is, probably. But it's just, oh, she's so wonderful in the song, and it's so powerful. And then, you know, of course, the imagery of the song is just beautifully done. And it just, the song captures the spirit of what the movie is trying to tell. It captures the spirit of that morality tale that I keep talking about, that this story is fundamentally focused on, which is the idea that we're not savages. We're not savages, and you are not a savage. We are equal. We are alike. Just because we don't look like you, just because you don't know us doesn't mean that we're not as intelligent or like you. We are the same. We are equal, and we can learn from each other. And we need to understand that we can, you know, be together, well, not be together romantically, but, you know, to look at each other equally. And, like, this, it captures that spirit, you know, along with having that sort of environmental message. Because, you know, that's sort of the other thing this movie, in a way, captured, was an environmental message that was starting to grow during the 90s as well. And it's not as adamant as I think people made it out to be in the 90s. You know, because I have memories of, like, people, you know, praising the environmental message a lot in this film when it first came out. But, yeah. Colors in the Wind, just brilliant. And I think really the last one that I can think of is in The Savages. And I know people have a problem with it now, especially now, because it's the word used. But again, it's the word that was used during that time period. And I think people miss the point of the film. Again, it's not depicting savages as a good word. In fact, the word savages throughout the film is depicted as a horrible word to use. And sort of that's the point in this song, is they keep using the word savages, and it's the word here, and I think it fits the song perfectly too, because of the way the song is played melody-wise. It's a very dark song, and that word is depicted as sort of ignorance of the other side. You know, again, they're savages because they don't think like us. They're savages because, you know, they fear us. And they're savages because they want to kill us. And so we need to kill those savages first. And in turn, by thinking like that, that turns that side into savages. You know, by the settlers thinking that the Indians are savages is due to fear, they themselves become savages. And vice versa. And it's, again, I think it's really well done by the movie to sort of show that within the song. And then a particular towards the end, as they're starting to get towards each other, and then Pocahontas with the undercut melody. I actually really enjoyed it. But there's a larger pacing issue that's more particular to do with the story. And that really goes to the back half of the film, I think, being a bit too much rushed. But we'll get more into that when we get into story proper. And going lastly, the score is just absolutely beautiful, as I said. Again, a lot of it combining with the music, a lot of it being very much intertwined. I very much enjoy it. That brings us to animation. My God, do I love the animation. I think it's really well done. You can very much see that the overall style is very much based on sort of the painting stylings of the early 1600s. And, you know, again, I think what really sort of makes that obvious is where, you know, they start and end the film in those black and white oil paintings, as if it's like the paintings that are hanging up in like the Historical Society in Virginia. And because that, I love the style, it's sort of very, there's a lot of, I should know the name of this style, but it's sort of English Renaissance style to the overall art style. And then there are elements of sort of Native American art going in here and there with triangles and the way the shells are played. And again, like with the Settlers, there's more of, again, that English Renaissance style in their character designs and in the ship design, everything. Whereas you have sort of more old Native American art style, more when you are at the Indian side and the Native American side. And there's just a sort of a fusion of those two art styles that I think flows wonderfully throughout the movie. And I think it's really, really well done. So I very much enjoy the overall art style of this film. I think it was a really great choice to sort of blend sort of English Renaissance with Native American, late Native American art. And it definitely helped give it that sort of new world vibe. And like I said, that flows right into the character designs. I very much enjoy Pocahontas' character design. Her color scheme, I think, really works for the character. You know, in particular, once she gets the necklace and you have that green, it really makes her stand out among the other characters. Again, there's a lot of earthy colors with all the other Native Americans. But again, she has that sort of a brightness, that green, that earthy sort of emerald, that really makes her character jump off the screen and jump out from the rest of the crowd. And, well, same with John Smith. If you really look at the way the Settlers are all designed, even Ratcliffe, you know, Ratcliffe is in this deep, dark, burgundy red, and he's big and burly and cumbersome, and you know, all the other Settlers have sort of a brown, like a dirty English brown color to them. They're down in the dirt. But then you have John Smith, you know, with a sort of, I don't want to say if it was steel, because I can't remember. I don't think steel had been completely dug. Well, I know it had been discovered at the time, but I don't know if that was steel or just iron, plated. I think it was steel. I'm sure, is going to correct me on that. But sort of the shiny silver, steel / iron plating they had. He has the white shirt underneath the you know, the silver hat, infinite, brighter than the rest of the Settlers. You know, you add the blonde hair there. And again, I don't know enough to know what John Smith looked like in real life, so. But I think for both Pocahontas and John Smith, there was a conceited effort to make them very much different than the rest of their groups. You know, Pocahontas popped, you know, her color scheme and her character design had her really pop out from the rest of the Native Americans, and the same could be said for John Smith. And again, that really goes to that sort of Romeo-Juliet vibe of, like, here are these two characters who really are very much different from the rest of their so-called tribes, but are also perfect for each other. And again, that, like I said, that goes to that sort of Romeo-Juliet vibe that really, the story is really a real retelling of, in a way. So I love that about the character designs. You know, I made mention of Ratcliffe, his very rotund size, gives him a sense of presence, to where it makes it believable that, you know, even though they hate him, they still follow him. And I think I really like the Native American designs, because I think it's, again, like I said, I love the colors. I think the Native Americans were made to look very regal, a lot more regal than the Settlers. In fact, I think a lot of time and effort were taken to really make Native Americans look a lot more respectable than the Settlers. And I think that works for the story because, again, you're depicting as, you know, as the story unfolds, like I said, the Native Americans are completely in the right, depending in what happens. You know, it's their land. The Settlers invade their land without permission, just form up a colony and start digging holes for gold. I have strange weapons, and, you know, at first sight of the Native Americans, they shoot them. You know, they have right to be fearful of the settlers. And I think that sort of regal design of the Native Americans helps in that as well. And the backgrounds and special effects, I mean, the backgrounds themselves, the waterfalls, the mountaintops, the forests, oh my God, it's all so beautiful. It pops off the screen. And the way they interchange and intergo throughout trees and into mountains and everything. And it's like, it feels like they just grab you and they pull you into a world. It is so beautifully done. It's like, if nothing else, 90s Disney should be known for the fact that the reason hand-drawn animated worked so well is because the worlds they created, the backgrounds, the special effects, and just the art in general pulled you into these worlds. I felt like I was in 1600 Virginia. And it just, it made everything more real. It made everything more believable. It brought me into this world. And it made me feel it. So, the art, I mean, it should be expected, but the art is just beautiful. In fact, I don't think, unfortunately, because of sometimes the controversy, Pocahontas doesn't get talked enough among people. And it's a real shame because the art of Pocahontas is just absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I would say the movie, in a way, is almost worth watching just for the art. Because it's so beautiful to look at the scene and look at the depth and the detail of the forests and the way, like, you can look into it. It's like, oh my God, I want to jump in there and explore. So overall, I really enjoy all of the art of this film. With that, time for a break and time to play some commercials for some wink, wink sponsors. Wink, wink. They're not paying me anything. They're friends whose podcast I really want you to listen to. And when we come back, we're going to get into acting and we're going to get into stories. So we'll be right back, folks. After these messages, we'll be right back.
Saturday Morning Fever, the new show from the Fire and Water Podcast Network celebrating the classic Saturday morning cartoons. Available on fireandwaterpodcast.com, iTunes, and Stitcher. Saturday Morning
Fever. Batman Nightcast, a thrilling new podcast from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Hosted by Ryan Daly
and Chris Franklin, Nightcast chronicles the Caped Crusaders' adventures in Batman and Detective Comics after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Highlights from this legendary era include
Batman number 400,
Legends,
Mike Barr and Alan Davis,
Batman Year 1,
Batman Year 2,
Max Allen Collins,
ugh,
the new Jason Todd,
ugh,
Millennium,
You're not doing this right. Let me take over. Alan Grant and Norm Breyfogle.
Alan Grant from Jurassic Park?
Did you hear me say Norm freaking Breyfogle?
Oh, yeah.
Son of the Demon.
The Killing Joke.
A Death in the Family.
Batman Year 3.
A Lonely Place of Dying.
Alan Grant, Alan Davis, Max Allan Collins. Why are there so many people named Alan from this era of Batman?
The Rise of Tim Drake.
Legends of the Dark Knight.
And that's just up until 1989.
Did anything exciting happen with Batman after that?
You'll have to tune in to find out.
Batman Nightcast, part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Find it on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Oh, we forgot to mention your favorite issue, when Batman fires Dick Grayson.
You want to find another co-host?
As Pocahontas, with, like I said, Judy Kahn, as the singing voice, as I made mention to earlier. Mel Gibson as John Smith. You know, he's the big name on the box. John Cassier as voices Miko, with Frank Wickler, Frank Weckler, because of course it's Frank. You know, you need an animal sound, we need to get Frank, voicing the hummingbird Flint. Linda Hunt as Grandmother Willow. Russell Means as Chief Powhatan. Christian Bale, swear to me, was not quite yet in his vocabulary yet, as he voiced Thomas. In fact, it's one of those things like, wait a minute, that was Christian Bale? Like I said, swear to me, wasn't yet in his vocabulary. And I warned you that the Dark Knight puns and jokes and references were not finished at all. David Ogden Steers as both Governor Ratcliffe and his assistant, pulling double duty. To start off, let's talk about the lead performances, because I think really what helps this movie is two very strong performances from both Mel Gibson and Irene Bedard. Both of them make their characters so believable, especially Irene. Really nailed Pocahontas, nailed, I think, her personality wonderfully, and just made her an engaging, energetic character. And you combine that, with wonderfully done art, like, for instance, there's a scene where, John Smith first tries to ambush her when he jumps out of the waterfall and he first sees her and she slowly goes up and there's that sort of serene look. And even he realized, like, this is something different. Like, just her regalness there, and that's an art-wise. But that's also something that I think, carried within Pocahontas as well, is a sort of a regalness, a sort of leadership, a charisma of leadership, as opposed to a festival of friendship. And it comes back to wrestling. By the way, folks, it's like 8 o'clock at night. It's like SmackDown just started, so I'm like, I'm missing SmackDown to do this. Not that I'm complaining, but wrestling thoughts may pop into my head at any time right now, as they just did. But no, just that charisma of leadership that I think Irene puts into the character. And then Mel Gibson, and say what you want about political views of his, the DUI. I mean, whether he's had these thoughts all the time or whatnot, basically, that did not happen until about the early to mid-thousands, so this was more of Lethal Weapon Mel Gibson. Not that this was Lethal Weapon Mel Gibson, but this was mid-90s Mel Gibson. But regardless, I think he did a very job, and he added a very an energy to John Smith that made him likable. Like, he made him innately different. And the story adds to this, again, when you start the film and they're in the storm And Thomas goes overboard. And, like, Alieta's like, I'm not going in for him. And John's, like, the first, like, Titus around him, and I'm going in. And saves Thomas. Like, it gives you an instant likability to that character, regardless of what he may do or the stupid things he may say later. You know, like, here's a person who, when he sees another person in trouble, regardless of who they are or what their class or whatever it is, he's going to save them. Like, there's a connectability there with that character. And I think that connectability and that sort of... because every person-ness is, like, too common of a term to use. But that in itself, I think... it's something that Mel Gibson brought to the character. Like, there's a believability, there's a commonness to him that, you know, you connect with just through the voice. And I think one of the things that Mel Gibson did really well with John Smith that made equally as strong as Irene's performance is how he portrayed John learning. You know, the fact of the matter is, in this story, Pocahontas is the teacher. Like, if we depict John Smith's character as going through a journey, you know, Pocahontas isn't just a prize, supposedly, the award as far as the hero's journey is concerned, as far as, you know, maybe their romance, but more importantly, Pocahontas is the teacher. Pocahontas is the one teaching him, giving him lessons to learn, and then later on, when he faces obstacles, he passes those because he's become tolerant, because he's learned to, you know, see people as equal to him regardless of what they look like. So, again, that's something that in his performance, Mel Gibson did a really good job of portraying. And so I think that lent itself to a very strong performance from him. And the same can be said for Irene. And again, like I said, that whole teacher aspect, she was really great. Again, that regalness, that charisma that she had, that charisma leadership. I keep using that because I think it fits really well. And again, that led us off to that whole teacher aspect as well. The rest of the supporting cast... I'm not going to say they were forgettable. I mean, Miko's way memorable. You know, his interactions with the dog. And I actually didn't write down the dog's name. I think it was Frank Weckler as well who did the dog as well. I could be wrong about that. But again, and that's just, you know, making animal sounds and, you know, well, and not to disown that. But again, and that's having an innate knowledge of, like, being able to do sort of animal-like sounds and or the sound you're going for that you're giving this animal and then acting through that, you know, Flint being sort of the stubborn one and the very overprotective one, and yet somehow Frank Weckler displays that through the character. So those animal supporting characters were done very well. I'll say this. The rest were, they weren't great, but they weren't forgettable. Like, they were good. They were good to average. They didn't hold down the story. I think Christian Bale was probably the standout on this one, mostly due to the fact that I think he did a great job of really lending a credible voice to portraying sort of somebody who is above his head. Like, he's obviously a character of Thomas is portrayed as somebody who is trying, he's gone on this journey to find himself, to become a man, and he's way above his head. Like, again, there's that whole teacher's moment to where, you know, he's shooting with his eyes closed, and, you know, John is like, you know, next time, keep both eyes open, which then lends itself to when, you know, he shoots Kokuom. Russell Means was very regal as, you know, Chief Padawan. And Linda Hunt. So some of the supporting cast was actually very good. I'm thinking more of like the little voices, the two other sort of characters sort of had Scottish accents, actually. Well, were funny in their own right. I won't lie. And they sort of became the like bigger voices of the entire settler group and the other men. But like I said, Linda Hunt was very funny as Grandma Willow. Very maternal. Like, you love listening to her. I can picture myself sitting on that stoop and just listening to story after story from her as Grandma Willow. So, like, I thought that was done very, very well as well. And then last but not least is the villain. And the problem with Governor Ratcliffe is not David Ogden Stiers. He did, I think, a really good job portraying the character because that was what was written for him. And it wasn't just a job that he walked in and did. Like, he put effort into it, and I enjoyed his performance of Governor Ratcliffe. The problem is that Governor Ratcliffe, as he's written, is a very weak villain character in regards to Disney, or at least in regards to the villains we had seen before. Like, this is after Lion King. So, like, the past four villains that we've seen, Scar, who took an active role in actually killing Mufasa and taking over the Pride Lands. Jafar, who had taken an active role in trying to capture the genie and take over Agrabah. Gaston, who took an active role in actually trying to, and almost for that matter, killing the beast. Ursula, who took active roles in changing Ariel, sabotaging her kissing the prince, and at least for a little bit, taking over the Kingdom of Atlantis. You know, you have these active, aggressive villains that are engaging and wonderful to watch and absolutely evil. And like, while Governor Ratcliffe is certainly greedy and power-hungry, his character is written very passive-aggressive and takes this very passive role. And while there's nothing wrong with having sort of a passive villain who's like behind the scenes doing everything, but there's so much more that you have to do with that to make that type of character engaging, and it's not done here. So, like, Ratcliffe never comes off as engaging. Like, from the moment you see him, you realize that, like, he's the type of character, the type of villain, for that matter, that's going to be, like, you know, the moment's going to come where he's going to, like, royally screw up and, like, everybody's going to turn on him. And you know that's coming. Even without knowing what the story of what happens, like, you know these characters, and it's, unless you engage the audience into that character in a way, they can be a bit plain. And not, again, it's not that the character, even as the character is written, that it's bad. But when compared to the more aggressive, more engaging, and exciting villains, like Justin Picker, of the last four, hell, the last five Disney films, because let us not forget, for that matter, Rescuers Down Under, and I'm blanking on the name of the villain, which, like, well, that should disprove your point. It's George C. Scott who voiced him. And just, like, enjoyed that role of the, you know, the hunter who was hunting the eagle. And just, like, oh, every bit of madness from that character. In fact, that character, in a way, is sort of the same as Governor Ratcliffe. Though different statuses, this is a governor, the leader of a settlement and everything, and he was just a hunter. But, like, at the same point in time, like, you look at the character that George C. Scott played in Rescuers Down Under, and, like, that's the type of engagement that you would need for Governor Ratcliffe. And so, I think that's really what was missing from it. Again, that's not David Ogden Stier's fault. That's how the character is written. And the time that was given to this character to sort of engage the audience was really that just that one song. The, you know, the digging song. No. And it just came off as a bit too passive. And I think also that goes to some pacing issues as well, which I'm sort of hinting that's sort of the big thing that really hurts this film. And again, we're going to get into that in just a couple minutes, because our next point is story. And, I mean, well, let's go to, well, let's start with the pacing issues. Since that's really the one big thing that I have a problem with in this film, and it's the thing that I think hurts this film the most, is its pacing issues. Like, this film seems like it could use, like, 10, 15 more minutes. You know, the film, you take away the credits, the film is 83 minutes, and it doesn't even fulfill the whole hour and a half time limit. And that's sort of the problem. It's like Disney had this standard of like animated films were only an hour and a half because they judged like as for it, that was sort of there was this math formula about how long a movie could go before it was not profitable anymore as far as being animated because of how many people would see it. And I think, unfortunately, that becomes a hindrance. Now, again, other films do accomplish it. And that's not to say that it's not that you can't obtain telling everything you want to tell within an hour and a half. But the way they were telling this story, this film in particular, because they were putting a lot of things, like, it could have used 10, 15 more minutes of, you know, sort of character development time in particular. A bit more development time for Governor Ratcliffe. A bit more time to maybe portray the relationship of Pocahontas and John Smith as happening over weeks at a time. Definitely they could have used at least 5 more minutes in portraying the ending, in the build up to war and Pocahontas' desperate attempt to, you know, save John Smith. Like, all of these moments could have used some more time, because, you know, and the film starts off okay, but as the film goes along, it starts picking up and be a little bit faster and a little bit faster and going through story points faster than it was before. And particular towards the end, it just feels a bit rough. And it forces the, and this is what hurts, I think, the song Savage, in a way. It's what hurts the ending of the film and everything, is that the song, or should I say, because of the pacing, the ending, and I faintly remember, by the way, like, a couple of years ago, when I initially tried to review this film, that I remember reviewing this and saying this, and I guess somehow it not getting out. By the way, maybe it is out, maybe people have a copy of this, and like, well, you did this, well, I can't seem to find it, by the way. I faintly remember that saying that it came off as sort of like the, you know, after school special. I had to think about that for a second. Like, what did I say about it way back when? But it has this sort of after school specialness to the ending. Like, you know, and now we need to teach each other, you know, how to respect. And, you know, we have to know that we're all equal. And then there's sort of this after school specialness. And I think I can tie that directly to the pacing throughout this film. And I think that hurts it in the long run. And that's because there were so many good things being told, I think, in this movie. You know, you start off with the plot. You know, at the end of the day, the plot is a Romeo and Juliet type story. It's the story of, know, two lovers who come from two different tribes that distrust and hate each other, and, you know, sort of, and sort of the tragedy of their love. They love each other and they're trying to bring their tribes together, but, you know, as in with most cases of, you know, because there are some Romeo and Juliet stories that, you know, have the more happy ending, because they're, you know, Romeo and Juliet stories are a romantic story with a happy ending. It's just that the happy ending, traditionally, is not them surviving their deaths, but it's their love surviving in an eternal heaven type of idea. You know, the idea that their love transcends time, space, and stuff like that. In this case, the sort of their love of John and Pocahontas surviving, is it transcending oceans, transcending locations, because they're in love with each other, and even though Pocahontas has to stay to take care of her tribe, and John needs to go back to England because it's the only way he can, you know, be healed from the gunshot, you know, what. In a way, it doesn't make sense, because, like, how do you go to the New World and not bring a doctor who can take care of a gunshot wound? I don't know. that doesn't actually make any sense, quite honestly. But still, it's that, like, he has to go back, and so while they're going to be parted, they'll still love each other, and that love will transcend oceans, at least until Pocahontas 2, Electric Boogaloo. I could not resist the joke. But again, and that's how the plot is told. And there's a reason those stories work, because again, in particular for the themes that they're going for, you know, here are two people who come from different worlds, but they see, you know, they see each other as equal, they see each other, you know, as something special, and they connect. Despite the fact that their tribes don't want them to, out of fear of losing some idea of power, which is, that's the other thing that Romeo and Juliet does, is Romeo and Juliet also warns of, in a way, of not seeking peace, of creating war out of differences. Like, look at the tragedy, look at these two young people whose lives are ruined because of our obsession with power and war. That's something that's actually not talked about the Romeo and Juliet storyline, is, you know, everybody focuses on the romantic aspects of it, and certainly I do too, because I am a hopeless romantic, but not enough people focus on sort of the power dynamic, to where the real tragedy is, here you have two tribes who may be very alike, but due to fear and distrust, and fear, more importantly, of losing some idea of power and status, you know, it leads to these two young, energetic lovers to their tragic deaths or tragic fate, or in this case, them, you know, being pulled apart from each other. And that's sort of like, that's the consequences of desperately grabbing onto power. And it could have been worse in this story had Pocahontas not, you know, selfishly sacrificed did sacrifice and saved John Smith. You know, she threw herself upon him, and this goes into the theme of acceptance for people who are different than you. You know, again, this whole film, you know, Colors of the Wind, the real big theme was, you know, here are these two groups of people. Here, you know, you have the English settlers who, yes, are invading a land that they do not own, and yes, they're doing it under the guise of Christianity and this idea that they are superior to any other culture. And again, culture is a big thing. The idea that your culture is better than my culture. You know, again, this whole idea also lends itself to culture. And then, of course, you have the Indians who, again, they don't know these settlers. They've never seen their weapons. And they distrust them, and there's this fear, and let's be honest, rightfully so, as history would turn out, that they would lose power and status to this group of new arrivals to their land. But again, so fear sets in, fear of loss of status, fear of loss of power, fear of all of these things, fear of the other. And Pocahontas is the one who understands that we shouldn't fear each other. We should be able to understand each other. We can both live on this land together. And again, so and through Colors Wind teaching John, and John being the one willing to try to help get these tribes to work together, because in a way, that's what the settlers were. They were a new tribe. They're just a tribe that came from across the ocean. And so that idea that we need to learn to accept each other, we're different. We're not savages. The Native Americans aren't savages, and neither are the settlers. And that's a very important lesson to teach. And then, of course, that being encapsulated by the fact that, you know, they're letting fear get to them, and so Pocahontas laying on John Smith as her father is about to bash his head and saying, like, you know, if you want to kill him, you're going to have to kill me. Because he is no different than you. You know, this idea that we should not be spilling our blood over petty differences. And that is something, even to this day, and for days to come, for our future, this story will always be relevant in that sense. I mean, think about sort of the stories that go on today. Hell, just the sort of the culture wars between, you know, of language and pop culture, and, you know, this character should look this way, and this character should look this way, and, you know, or political talk or everything, we constantly portray ourselves as like, oh, they're of this opinion, or of this culture, of this race, of this sexual identification, or whatever, and that's different for me, so they have to be evil. And they're not. They're just like us. And we need to learn that lesson. We always need to relearn that lesson over and over again. Because we need to understand that we are very much the same. There are a lot of things that make us different, special, and unique. But that doesn't make us a danger to each other. And we need to stop worrying about our status and the type of power we have and the type of control we have over things that are really out of our control. And rather look at what makes us all alike and understand that as alike, to treat each other equally and fair, and to realize that we can work together. It's sort of the major theme that goes throughout the story. And again, using the Romeo and Juliet story intertwined with that really makes that story work. Again, like I said, they have pacing issues that makes the ending feel rushed, but it's still there. I mean, the ending still works. It's, again, like I said, it's not so much that the ending doesn't work. It's that it just feels rushed and comes off as after-school specialist, if that makes sense. There is also the minor theme to talk about with environmentalism. It's really touched on lightly. Again, they're, you know, here come the settlers are just digging up the earth for gold. They're mining it for gold as if all the earth is all that matters about the earth is, you know, mining up minerals and important and valued stones and precious metals. But there is sort of that depiction of like, look, these settlers are just coming in. Man comes in and just destroys the earth, and the Native Americans are shown as ones living with the earth. The ideas of environmentalism that's in this film are very, very subtle. It's really not talked about, but like there are lines here and there that sort of intertwine the movie with a sort of environmental message that I think actually works very, very well. It's more of like showing how beautiful the world is And look at these settlers just digging it up. By the way, one of the lines is at the end of Colors in the Wind, where, you know, she's saying, you can own the earth and still all you own is earth until... And it sort of the signal being sent there is like, you look at the earth as some type of precious thing to own, but it's not something. It's something to be... It is precious, but it's not... But it's so precious that it's not something that is made to be owned. And mind you, the other part of that line, the focus, you know, the idea that, you know, you can own the earth, but you're still just owning earth. You know, you're no different than us. In that way. So, again, the environmental message, it's there. It's one of those things that's shown, not said. And so that's why it's a minor theme. That's done sort of, like I said, it's done through sight, not sound. Through the images, through the depicting of the Native Americans living with culture as opposed to settlers who are just destroying it. I guess the last thing is to talk about the comedy. And there's funny moments. I mean, really the mainstay of the comedy comes between Miko. I'm blanking on the name of the dog because I didn't write down the name of the dog. But that, and of course Flint, and it's funny, it's, you know, in particular with Mako, just sort of the intelligent qualities, you know, the that whole point to where he kind of brings John Smith to the bush to get Flint mad and cause Flint to try to buzz and attack him so that the biscuits, after, you know, John Smith had given him biscuits, would fly out so that he can get all the biscuits. And then as John C. leaves, he's like finishing off the biscuits. And he wipes his little nose, and the crumbs fall, and he's like, and then licks his fingers, and like all the crumbs, and like he's constantly eating, like, you know. I find that very funny. You know, raccoons are always funny, and I think that's sort of the mainstay of the comedy, and it's very light on the comedy, but the comedy also comes off as very natural. Like when there are funny moments, they come off as natural. I think a great example of this is, one is, you know, when Pocahontas dives off the waterfall at the beginning, and, you know, her friend is like, no, not that way, and then, you know, Pocahontas scores a perfect dive, and then, like, I'm not coming in there for you, and she turns over the boat, and there's the two girls in the water, and it's like, you know, you aren't we getting a little too old for this? And then the girls start playing underneath the capsized canoe in the air pocket. And there's something very natural about two friends just playing with her. It's very funny and everything. And, of course, the phone with Biko taking the dive. And then, like, wait a minute. What in God's name was I thinking? Grabs Flint and, like, tries to, like, stand on top of Flint. Which leads to the whole bullseye thing. Again, just sort of the comedy between friendships, and like, when in doubt, hit the bird. Another sort of, I think, example of this sort of naturalness is, I think, come from Mel Gibson. You know, Mel Gibson has a very natural comedic aspect to him that comes out throughout the movie. It's like, you know, for instance, where Miko takes the compass, and it's like, oh, and Poker's like, Miko's like, oh, don't worry, he can't hurt it. Miko bangs against the rock. Hey! He's like, don't worry, you can have it. I'm gonna go back to London. Call it a gift. There's something very natural about that delivery that makes that comedy work. And so a lot of the comedy throughout the movie, Grandma Willow's comedy is hilarious. Grandma Willow is just funny throughout the film. As a sort of maternal grandmother, it's like, you wink, 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 wink. Yeah, so it's... The comedy comes off very natural, and I think it works very much with the film. Closing comments. Oh, God, this film. I really actually enjoy this film. I mean, the film was a commercial success. I think, like, making over $300 million... which was huge for that time. If I can find my phone, I actually can bring up the official number. Box off budget was $55 million and made a box office of $346 million, $346.1 million. So it was considered a success. But this film also is the beginning of the back half of the Disney 90s renaissance. You know, if you look at, you know, those first four as those immensely successful films of Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and Lion King, and then you have that back half, which includes Pocahontas, Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mulan, Hercules, and Darwin Tarzan, though one could argue that Tarzan in its way was also the end and at the same time the beginning of sort of that last hurrah of animated films that would be in the thousands. Things like Atlantis, Treasure Planet, excuse me, Home on the Range, Brother Bear, you know, among other things. But that's, I think, getting ahead of ourselves. This is a film that is really good. I think the story is really, really solid. In fact, brilliant in places. The way they intertwine sort of a classic sort of Romeo-esque Juliet tale with the theme of acceptance, which is very natural to the Romeo-Juliet tale. And that idea of that we're all equal and we're all the same and we need to treat each other equal and fair. I think that morality tale is really brilliant and worth watching this movie for. And I think there are a lot of positives that come out of watching this movie from that standpoint too. But the music is beautifully done. The animation is gorgeous. The acting is really solid. It, end of the day, Pocahontas is just an enjoyable film. Despite feelings people might have these days about its historical accuracy or inaccuracy. At the end of the day, it's not meant to be historically accurate. It's a fairy tale. It's, you know, all the things I made mention before in my very long-winded discussion at the beginning of this episode. But at the end of the day, I enjoyed Pocahontas. I think Pocahontas is very enjoyable. And it's a very fun watch. Solid cast. Beautiful animation. Great songs, including one of the best Disney songs of all time in Colors in the Wind. And a really engaging story with themes tied together that unfortunately suffers from pacing issues. I think it's worth checking. I mentioned it's worth checking out. But those are all sort of, that's the summarization of really everything that I feel with this film. All that being said, I think this is a great film. I think it's a must watch. As I think of all Disney 90s Renaissance films, I think all of them are must watches. So I think this is very enjoyable. I think ultimately that this film could have had, or could have used 10 to 15 more minutes for storytelling purposes and character development and other things, but it's still a very solid movie and a wonderful movie to watch. So I give Pocahontas a 4.5 out of 5. That's really, really good. Just suffers from those pacing issues. So that's it for my review of Pocahontas. And I apologize for the ultra-long episode. I think I say that every time. Because every time I get into long-winded discussions at the beginning of the episode. One of these days, I'm going to get into the review like 5 minutes in. And everybody will be happy. But thank you for hopefully enjoying this review. Remember, you can leave comments on the site itself or at our email at absolutionnetwork132@gmail.com. Remember to check out our friends. Remember to check out all other 132 production content. And next time out, ladies and gentlemen, in preparation for Moana, which we're going to do at the end of the month. I do hope to get one more Disney review out. And we're going to cover something from the thousands. We actually have not covered the thousands a lot. I think outside of Princess and the Frog, Princess and the Frog, still technically thousands, 2009. But I think really the only two we've covered is Atlantis and Princess and the Frog. So we're very much behind on 2000 Walt Disney animated films. But we're going to sort of cover one. And since we're going to cover Moana, which deals with Polynesian and sort of Pacific culture, well, we cover the other film that delved into sort of Pacific culture in a way. Except it was sort of a combination. Or it wasn't much about Pacific. Oh, it was about Pacific culture, but more, it took place in Hawaii. I think you know what film I'm talking about. I'm talking about the film that was more of a space adventure in its own way than it was about any one culture. I'm talking about the buddy comedy Lilo and Stitch. That's next time on The Prerogative. But until next time, I'm the Generation.
Find cover. It's going to get too dangerous.
Stay gold.
Hope you enjoyed it. This is Tom signing off. And until we meet again, you know the rest.